Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Christian and his companion walked with great delight. They drank also of the water of the river, which was pleasant and enlivening to their weary spirits.
I do find it so fascinating being on this trail that we're going to all these places that Bunyan knew and loved and that he had a relationship with, and I think it somehow permeates the writing, that kind of love of place.
Gosh, so it's crazy to think that it was on this site that Bunyan was imprisoned for that long a time, 12 years, and also that this is where he started to write, this is where he was given paper and pen. As I walked through the wilderness of this world, I lighted on a certain place where was a den, and I laid me down in that place to sleep, and as I slept, I dreamed a dream. That's the first sentence of The Pilgrim's Progress, from this world to that which is to come, delivered under the similitude of a dream. A fictional Christian allegory by John Bunyan, which Robert McCrum has described as the ultimate English classic. It was first published in 1678 and translated into several European languages in Bunyan's lifetime, and has seen thousands of different editions. 200 years after Bunyan's death, it was claimed that every household in England possessed two books, the Bible and a copy of The Pilgrim's Progress. The most cultivated man cannot find anything to praise more highly, and the child knows nothing more amusing, said Samuel Johnson, and the historian E.P. Thompson called it one of the foundation texts of the English working class movement. It's inspired writers as diverse as William Blake and William Makepeace Thackeray, Charlotte Bronte, Mark Twain, C.S. Lewis, John Steinbeck, and Enid Blyton. Hello and welcome to On the Road with Penguin Classics, the podcast that takes a stroll around the world's favourite books. I'm Henry Elliott, the author of the Penguin Classics book, and in this episode, I'm going on a pilgrimage from the City of Destruction along the narrow path to the Celestial City, and I'm hoping to meet various demons, giants, and hobgoblins, as well as other pilgrims along the way. But first, let me introduce our guest for today's episode. Very lucky to be joined by the novelist Rachel Joyce. Rachel, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
The novelist Rachel Joyce began her career as an actor, performing leading roles for the RSC, the National Theatre, and Cheek by Jowl, and she began writing radio plays for BBC Radio 4 in the late 90s. In 2007, she wrote a play, To Be a Pilgrim, which she expanded and published as a novel in 2012 as The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. And it became a phenomenon. It was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Book Prize, longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and is an international bestseller. Since then, her novels have sold over 5 million copies worldwide, and they have been translated into 36 different languages. In 2014, she published a companion to Harold Fry, The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy. And 2022 sees the publication of the concluding part of the trilogy, Maureen Fry and the Angel of the North. Rachel, Harold Fry has been described as a Bunyan-esque allegory. And at one point in the novel, a character tells Harold that what you're doing is a pilgrimage for the 21st century. Can you remember when you first came across John Bunyan and The Pilgrim's Progress, and And do you think you had it in mind while you were writing Harold Fry?
I think it was very much in my mind when I was writing the book, but partly because I'm that generation at school who we did read Pilgrim's Progress and Canterbury Tales and yes. the Iliad and the Odyssey. And I was actually one of those children who really loved them. So I think it was very much in my mind, if not consciously, when I was writing The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, because you have all those kind of universal and archetypal images, and also so much about structure that I really think influenced how I write generally, but very much that book.
Well, I'm really looking forward to unpacking that over the course of today. And of course, the epigraph to Harold Fry are the lyrics to the famous hymn, To Be a Pilgrim, which comes from Pilgrim's Progress.
It does. And in fact, as you know, as you said, the radio play was called To Be a Pilgrim. I felt it was very much, you know, following in the steps of that.
Well, we're going to make our own pilgrimage today. And let's start by describing where we're standing, because we're standing in the middle of the city of Bedford, in Bedfordshire, and we're standing on St. Peter's Green, underneath a rather impressive statue of John Bunyan in his 17th century cloak, holding out a book and in the act of preaching. I imagine it's the Bible that he's holding. And so this feels like an appropriate spot to head off from on a pilgrimage to discuss John Bunyan and his works. Rachel, as we walk through the streets of Bedford, I wonder, can you remember what it was that drew you to writing about pilgrimage in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of things, but I think one is just that I was really fascinated by what a pilgrimage would mean now if you're not, you know, a churchgoer. So what is it you're trying to find, and what is it you'll find along the way? Those things really, really interest me and still do. But also, a journey is, you know, it's such a brilliant storyline, because it, you know, by necessity a story is a journey, but if you have an actual journey as well, there's so much you can do with landscape that can reflect or get in the way of your hero's journey. So it's, you know, it's such a classic structure. I mean, it continues to draw me. I keep writing stories about people going on journeys. I don't seem to be able to help it, but I'm going to try and write one where somebody stays at home next.
Well, and of course that, I mean, that's exactly what Bunyan was tapping into with his book, wasn't it? You know, the excitement of a journey and that
yes.
narrative drive that it gives a story.
Yes.
So we've turned down St. Cuthbert Street, and we're standing opposite a little cottage with a blue plaque which says, on this site stood the cottage where John Bunyan lived from 1655. And so it was on this spot that Bunyan was living when he wrote The Pilgrim's Progress. And so that opening moment where he dreams of a man, he says, I dreamed and behold, I saw a man clothed with rags, standing in a certain place, with his face from his own house, a book in his hand, and a great burden upon his back. Now, this is the pilgrim. This is the character we're going to be following through this narrative. And he's standing with his back to his house. We can imagine him standing at that front door, perhaps, and setting off from here on his journey. And we're going to be following his footsteps today, by foot and in the car as well, making our own pilgrimage from this, the city of destruction in the book, to the celestial city at the end of our journey. But you have a similar moment in Harold Fry, don't you, when Harold is, he reaches the threshold of his house, and his life has sort of become smaller and smaller, and he hardly leaves the house, really. And there's a moment at the threshold where he smells the warmth and the salt air rushing into his nose. And I feel like there's a similar moment of him issuing out into the story.
There definitely is. But there was also that moment where, you know, right at the beginning of Pilgrim's Progress, he's asking, what shall I do? And the question, you can see, is really, you know, it's tormenting him and eating him up that he doesn't know what to do to ease that burden. And I very much had that in mind. I think it's a great starting point for a story of just when you see that there is a state of stasis or sleepfulness, you know, or the kingdom is dead, and what can be done to bring back life. So I think that you know, that was very much in my mind, but also just looking at the cottage now and thinking of him then, and then us standing here now and people walking past, wheelie bins outside. It's a sort of mad conflict you get, don't you, between the past and the present, where both feel alive.
Absolutely, there's layers. You can sort of unpeel them like an onion, can't you? Definitely. One of the reasons he was based here and stayed here was that, as I said, he was a preacher, and his congregation started to meet just around the corner in a place where they still continue to meet today. So let's go on to hear a little bit more about his life and his work.
I saw in my dream that the man began to run. Now, he had not run far from his own door, but his wife and children, perceiving it, began to cry after him to return. But the man put his fingers in his ears and ran on, crying, "Life! Life! Eternal life!" So he looked not behind him, but fled towards the middle of the plain.
Wow, we're just coming up to the Bunyan Meeting, the meeting house of the Bunyan community. It's a really impressive building. The congregation started meeting here in 1672 when one of them bought a simple barn in an orchard just here for £90. But they've met on this site ever since, and the building was replaced in 1707, and then this very grand red brick neoclassical building was built in 1850.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Gosh. Well, let's head on in. I think we're expected.
Henry,
hi.
Officer.
John, yes. Very good to meet you. Hi, this is Rachel Joyce, the novelist.
Hello. Come on in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then straight through, and you're in the church itself.
Right.
Gosh, so we've just stepped into the church, and it's a beautiful, big, open, airy space, a gallery running right round each side of it, a big organ at the end. And my first impression is just so much light coming in, and it's beautifully painted in white and sky blue. It's a very welcoming space. And we're really lucky to have been allowed into the meeting house today, and we're meeting John Pestel, who is a volunteer here at the John Bunyan Museum and Church. And he's also the author of a book called Travel with John Bunyan, which gives you, it's a brilliant book, which gives you great tips on how to follow in the footsteps of Bunyan and the Pilgrim's Progress. John, can I start by asking you a rather big question, but who was John Bunyan? Why is he a significant character?
Well, John Bunyan was born in the early part of the 17th century, not far from the centre of Bedford, in a little hamlet in the parish of Elstow. He was born into a low-class family who were braziers.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, they were menders of kettles and pots and pans, metalworkers.
Right.
He was actually rather a rogue.
Right.
Around the village, he was the nuisance boy. He suffered terribly with nightmares, which made matters worse. And he was also a notorious swearer, foul-mouthed.
Excellent.
So much so that the village shopkeeper, who herself was known for her language, reprimanded him one day for such language, saying to him that he would taint the whole town with such behaviour.
Wow, that's incredible. And, you know, what did he go on to do? You know, what's a potted sort of description of Bunyan as a writer?
When he was 16 years of age, his mother died of influenza, followed a month later by his sister, and within 3 or 4 months, their father remarried for the third time.
Gosh.
And all this family trauma seemed to upset John, because within weeks he had joined Oliver Cromwell's side of the Civil War army, and he was billeted over in Buckinghamshire at Newport Pagnell. And so he was in the army for 2.5 years, came out, and there was then some reconciliation back home, because he rejoined the family firm, and he started to settle down as the mender of pots and pans with his father. He was now 19 years of age, thereabouts. By the time he's 20, he must have married because there's an entry in the village church register of marriage.
Right.
And the birth of a child in 1650. His wife, we don't know her name. We know that she had a religious upbringing, and that pious way of living began to affect John. Mm. And we see over some years a real change and conversion in his life, and he settles down. And by the time he's around 27 years of age, there's a complete conversion in his life. He attends church regularly, and during his working life, he met up with some women in the town centre here in Bedford who were worshippers of the origins of the church we're now standing in.
Uh-huh.
And as he sat and listened to them, he realised he was out of his depth, because they had a real strong faith in Jesus Christ and the things of Scripture. And he really only had sort of a head knowledge of all this. Mm. And all this began to affect his way of life. They introduced him to the first minister of this church, who had, if you like, Bible lessons with him.
Mm. Now, is that John Gifford?
Mr. John Gifford, that's
who
correct.
Who was a very important mentor for Bunyan.
He was indeed.
And appears in the Pilgrim's Progress as the character of the interpreter or the evangelist, a kind of... the person who opens this pilgrim's eyes to...
That's right, yeah. Uh-huh. And by the time we get to the mid-1650s, Bunyan's qualities are seen by the new church, and he goes out with men that actually leave the church to go preaching around the villages of Bedfordshire.
Uh-huh.
And that's how he gets into preaching.
By all accounts, he was an exceptional preacher, right?
And it's the fact that he was an exceptional preacher that the national authorities begin to get onto him and see him as a possible threat. And by the time we get to 1660 with a new king, Charles II, with new policies, they want him, as we'd say today, off the streets. So we have the arrest, and by the winter of 1660, early 61, he's in prison.
Right, and he spent many years in prison, and it was in prison that he began to write seriously.
Yes.
I guess he had a lot of time. But he started by writing a kind of spiritual memoir, sort of autobiography, of his conversion, which he published as Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. And it seems likely that the germ of an idea for the Pilgrim's Progress began while he was in prison, even though it was published a while later. But John, tell me just... can you give us a little bit more of the context? So why was he not allowed to preach? And what kind of a congregation was it that set up this church?
Mr. John Gifford was going against the established church.
Mm-hmm.
They were dissenters, non-conformists. They did not conform to the national church. Even today, this church is a non-conformist church.
Mm-hmm. It's such a fascinating time in history, isn't it? That interregnum, the time between the monarchies, all sorts of different versions of worship sprang up, didn't they? There was sort of tolerance during the interregnum, and then increasingly, once Charles II came back in, the authorities cracked down on these, on the dissenters, as you say. But how does the Bunyan Meeting and the Bunyan Museum continue to celebrate Bunyan's memory today?
Well, on the site, there is a dedicated museum, and we get visitors from all over the world. We have school children come in. It's on the local curriculum at schools around Bedfordshire. And the church itself is this year celebrating that 350th anniversary of the fact that Bunyan was released from prison.
Mm-hmm.
He received a license that year, 1672. And the church first met on this site in a barn of an orchard that was on this site originally. So it's a special year for Bunyan itself.
How fantastic. Well, what a perfect moment to be discussing him in this episode. And John, just to finish really, what kind of effect do you think Bunyan has had on the city of Bedford, given that this church is here and his statue stands on St. Peter's Green? How does Bedford regard their most famous...
Sadly, in the modern world, Bunyan isn't as revered as he was, particularly in the Victorian age. Mm. For example, on the front of this church, there are at the entrance two bronze doors that were established here in the late 19th century. And when they were installed and there was a dedication service, the street was crowded with over 3,000 people. They couldn't have all got in here, but such was the admiration for anything Bunyan. When the statue was erected in 1874, it was estimated there was a crowd of 10,000.
Wow.
School children were invited to the dedication. Following the unveiling, they were taken into the town centre, I believe it was the Corn Exchange, and it's reported they ate between them a ton of cake.
Wow, well, that's a real measure of support. Amazing. Wow. Well, what an extraordinary spot, and as you say, on the 350th anniversary of the congregation meeting here.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you for setting us up at the start of our pilgrimage. I feel like we've got a much clearer idea of who Bunyan was.
My pleasure.
And I'm really looking forward to the rest of our day. Thank you for inviting us in.
Thank you.
Well, we're about to head out of Bedford now, but before we go, let's just stop here on the corner of Silver Street and the High Street. Because this, in fact, look, here's a plaque on the floor which says that this was the site of Bedford County Jail, where John Bunyan was imprisoned for 12 years. And, well, today it's a ice cream shop called Sunday's Gelato. But, in fact, in John Pestle's book about Bunyan, he describes this site. He says, it is believed that it had two stories and two cells below ground level, one of which had no natural light. It must have been bitterly cold in winter, as there were no fireplaces, and the prisoners would have slept on straw. Gosh, so it's crazy to think that it was on this site that Bunyan was imprisoned for that long a time, 12 years.
12 years is a very long time.
It's a really long time. And also that this is where he started to write. This is where he was given paper and pen. And
so he was provided with paper and pen, was he?
Yes.
Even though he would be known to be a little dangerous?
I have a feeling that I've read that it actually wasn't too strict an imprisonment, and he was occasionally let out, in fact.
Right.
But I think he fathered a child while he was in prison, so I think there was definitely some shore leave while he was here. But I guess it sounds like, you know, if he spent most of his time here, it sounds pretty grim.
It does just make me think, though, about what makes people write and whether the environment that you're in can actually produce the writing. Just how interesting it is when people write stories that are about adventure or, you know, kind of beautiful places when they themselves are, you know, imprisoned and in a cell and constrained.
Yes. I mean, who you think of? Someone like Marco Polo describing his own travels while he was
in prison. I mean, I think of writers who, you know, for instance, won't look out of a window while they're writing. They only want to look at a wall because they want the freedom, I guess, for their imagination to go where it needs to go without being distracted by, you know, anything else.
How interesting.
But also just whether, if you are in prison like that, the need to escape is so kind of powerful that it can produce that kind of writing.
How interesting. So actually the very fact of confinement can actually be a kind of, can encourage your imagination.
Oh yes, and contribute to it, certainly. Or kind of provoke the need.
What a lovely idea. Well, now let's head south. Let's leave the prison. Let's leave the den that's in the opening line of Pilgrim's Progress and head over the bridge and off on our pilgrimage.
Now, I saw in my dream that just as they had ended this talk, they drew near to a very miry slough that was in the midst of the plain, and they, being heedless, did both fall suddenly into the bog. The name of the slough was Despond.
So we're just heading south out of Bedford now, and we're passing what used to be a sort of marshy area called Squitch Fen, which some people think might be the basis for one of the first areas that the pilgrim comes across,
which is called the Slough of Despond, this kind of marshy, miry area that's sort of constantly wet and muddy because of the... It's almost like the sort of side products of human sin drain into this awful marsh. And it's like a quicksand, isn't it? The pilgrim almost gets caught in it. So we can picture that as we head south out of Bedford. And it's interesting, I think, that that comes very near the beginning of Pilgrim's Progress. It's like there's an instant trap that you could stop you in your tracks. And it's only when a character called Help reaches out its hand and, and pulls Christian out of the Slough of Despond that he can carry on in his journey.
Yes, but actually shows him the step. He says, I'll show you the steps that are actually already there. It's just that they're very difficult
Good
to find.
Point. Yes, absolutely.
So the way out is there. It's just that you can become so bogged down by your own doubt or fear that you can't even help yourself out. I think that's what I find so kind of vivid about that detail at the beginning.
Yes, that is a brilliant detail. And I feel like the start of Harold Fry, there's a similar, he's sort of stuck in a rut, isn't he? How would you describe the relationship between Harold and his wife Maureen at the start of that?
Well, that kind of quagmire-y detail, I think, is very right for how I see the beginning. They're stuck in a place that they've been in basically for 20 years, where you've become so stuck that you can't see the stone steps, you can't see the way out, and the only thing to do is to stay, in the problem. So you stay in this place of not speaking, and even when you do use words, they're not meaningful words, they're about passing jam.
Right.
So I kind of felt it was, as I was saying earlier, it's where you, at the beginning of a story, I always kind of think to myself, right, what needs to be changed? What is the thing that, why does this story need to occur? And it felt to me that with Harold and Maureen, they were sitting at this breakfast table where they could have been sitting for 20 years, and they might well sit for another 20 years if Harold doesn't do something. And I think that's when you start thinking about the unconscious and that you can be propelled to do something that your soul needs you to do before you've even consciously found the words for it.
And in a way, there's a similar hand reached out to him, isn't there, at the start of the novel? His,
yes.
his letter arrives
yes.
from a woman from his past that he hasn't maybe thought about that much recently, a woman called Queenie Hennessy.
Yes.
And this is almost like that hand at the start of Pilgrim's Progress pulling him out
it's exactly
this.
The same. Right. It feels to me like that question, what can I do? And sort of realises very quickly that to write a reply isn't enough.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That actually you've got to do. Doing is the thing. But just what? What do you do?
And that is when he sets out on his pilgrimage.
Yes.
And I'm just saying we've just turned into a road called Progress Way.
Isn't that brilliant?
Isn't that excellent?
So you said when you're looking for the signs, you suddenly realise they're all there.
They're everywhere. And this is, we're coming into the small village of Elstow, just on the outskirts of Bedford. And this is where Bunyan was born, and this is where we're going to stop next to discuss the next step on his journey. And wow, gosh.
It's so pretty.
Lots of half-timbered buildings. It couldn't be much more of a sort of typical old English village, really, could it?
In process of time, Christian got up to the gate. Now, over the gate, there was written, Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. He knocked, therefore, more than once or twice, saying, May I now enter here?
Well, we're just walking onto the village green at Elstow, a really ancient open space, it seems. Look, there's this old post in the middle, which I think was, the centre of the markets that were held in this spot. And there's a very old-looking moot hall over there, again, half-timbered, a really spectacular building. And so in some ways, I think Bunyan would recognise the scene today. And it's on this green that a really significant event happened in Bunyan's life. He was, as a young man, he was playing a game here with friends on a Sunday, a game called Tip Cat, which I think was a sort of a ball game.
Right.
And of course, as a Christian, he shouldn't have been playing games on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And he wrote later in his memoir, he said, as I was in the midst of a game at cat, and having struck it one blow from the hole, just as I was about to strike it a second time, a voice did suddenly dart from heaven into my soul. which said, "Wilt thou leave thy sins and go to heaven, or have thy sins and go to hell?" And he later credited this moment, when a voice sort of came down to him at this spot, as being the sort of conversion moment that made him into a Christian.
It's an extraordinarily open space, though, still, isn't it? And you have a huge expanse of sky over you. You can imagine a crack in the clouds.
Now, at the start of the Pilgrim's Progress, after Christian has escaped from the Slough of Despond, he heads towards a small door, which he calls the Wicket Gate. And this is the entrance to the narrow path that's going to take him all the way to the Celestial City. And many people think that this gate is one of the doors into Elstow Abbey, which we're looking at now. So let's walk over there and see if we can find the Bunyan's Wicket Gate. We're just walking up to the abbey now, and its original foundation dates to 1075, so it's a really old church. So we're looking at a little door in the side of this old church with a very ornate archway over it. Now, when Christian, the pilgrim, gets to the Wicket Gate, a character called Goodwill lets him in, but pulls him through quickly because he says a little distance from this gate there is erected a strong castle, of which Beelzebub is the captain. And from thence both he and them that are with him shoot arrows at those that come up to this gate, if happily they may die before they can enter in. And the reason people think that maybe this is the Wicket Gate is that just next to it is a separate bell tower, a separate building to the church. It seems to be equally old. It's like a separate, almost like a campanile in
yes,
Italy.
Yes.
And yes, if you had a vivid imagination, you could imagine needing to get into that door before you were attacked from this fortress outside. Now, the Pilgrim's Progress was such a huge success that Bunyan went on to write a second part. And
yes,
the second part is pretty much the same pilgrimage, but
yes,
following his wife, Christiana,
yes,
and their children, following in his footsteps and retracing his route.
And isn't there a dog this time as well?
Always
good to bring in a dog, I think.
Well, there's certainly, when Christiana reaches this point at the Wicket Gate, she's almost too scared to enter because there's this terrifying barking from the other side of the door. And when Goodwill pulls her through, he explains that that's Beelzebub's dog, presumably in this bell
right,
tower that we're standing next to,
yes,
barking. I wondered, you know, at the end of the Love Song of Queenie Hennessy, you write that you don't see that as a sequel to Harold,
yes,
Fry. You say, "I've not written a prequel or a sequel. I would call this book a companion."
Yeah.
And I wondered, did you always envisage that there would be sequels to Harold Fry, or did those come along?
It sort of came along, but I mean, I did realise as I was writing the second, or the, you know, however I called it, that there were three books.
Mm.
But sometimes you know there are three, but you think you may not be able to write them all. And actually, if you don't mention it, nobody will know. So that's kind of what I did for a very long time. And then I think it was partly writing the screenplay for the film of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. We got very close to Maureen again, and I always knew it was Maureen's book that was missing. And I kind of knew the tone of it, but I just couldn't quite find it. And I think I wasn't ready to write it until I'd let go of something. And I think the film, and then actually being in Berwick-on-Tweed for the end of the filming, allowed me to say goodbye in some, you know, sort of strange way to the whole, because it's been with me for 10 years.
Of course.
And so I realised that Maureen's book, I'd always thought, was set at the same time as Harold Fry, but I realised it was set now. And then when I realised that, I thought, oh, I can round it off. I can do the trilogy.
Well, let's imagine we're passing through this small Wicket Gate. And as Goodwill says, we should look before us. Do you see the narrow way? That is the way you must go. It is as straight as a rule can make it. So we'll have to follow the roads, but we'll try to travel in as straight a route as possible along our pilgrimage today. Let's carry on. So, Rachel, one of the next locations that Christian, the pilgrim, comes to is the Hill of Difficulty. And this narrow path that he's following goes straight up over this very steep hill.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, one of the
elements of Harold Fry's pilgrimage, which kicks in very quickly, is the physical difficulty of making this walk. You know, he's quite unprepared. He's wearing his old boat shoes.
Wrong shoes, no equipment. Yeah.
But do you think the physical difficulty is part of what a pilgrimage is?
Yes, I do. I think that's one of the kind of first stages, I would say, is the physical hardship. As you pitch yourself against the walk and realise your own frailty, and also that you can try to push yourself too hard and then you can inflict damage, which is what Harold Fry does. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of then finding the gauge. It's kind of finding out about how you're going to do it in a kind of humble way, really, where you're recognising your body's limitations as opposed to just being so gung-ho, which Harold is at the beginning. And Christine is too, I would say, at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
You know, you're looking for, oh, well, how can I do this the easiest way? Because actually that hill looks really, really hard.
Yeah.
And isn't he at one point kind of doing it on his hands and knees?
Yes, he has to kind of crawl.
Like, really, really difficult. And that's what I love, that, because it's that's so contemporary an image. I can really get my head around it. I understand that.
Well, that makes total sense to me. And I wonder if we've been saying some of these names, like the Slough of Despond, the Hill of Difficulty, and these characters called Christian, called Help, called Faithful.
No Good, or whatever.
Exactly,
I love these names.
Exactly.
They're brilliant names. I kind of wish you could do it now and get away with it.
Yes, I suppose maybe the last person who was able to do it was Charles Kingsley in The Water Babies, but Mrs. Doozy would be done by itself. But, you know, obviously this book is an allegory, and I guess Bunyan was fitting into quite a rich tradition of allegories, if you think of something like William Langland's Piers Plowman, or the mystery plays, or the Everyman morality play.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that Roger Pooley, in the introduction to the Penguin Classics edition, he points out that before being a kind of genre of literature, allegory was a way that people would read the Bible. It was a kind of mode of reading, that you would look at stories from the Old Testament and read the inner meaning of it, sort of.
Yes.
So it was a very sort of Christian way of reading, was this kind of allegorical mode.
Yes. It's not really the way we read now, is it?
No, I suppose not.
I mean, I would say that poetry, that's more how we approach poetry, or something ancient like, you know, the I Ching, for instance, people who consult the I Ching, where you throw some coins and then you're kind of given answers, or not really answers, but solutions, things to think about. And they're always in terms of images. So it's not the kind of, it's not a kind of direct truth.
And it relies on your interpretation.
Exactly. And it gives you space as well, I think, to think not in an entirely literal way, which isn't really, I think, really how we read now. I think we do read in a much, you know, we kind of want the emotional truth, we want the kind of place truth. I think it's a bit harder for us to read like that.
Well, I was going to ask you, because, you know, Harold Fry is being compared to The Pilgrim's Progress, it's even being compared to the play Everyman, and I wondered, you know, to what extent do you see it as an allegorical novel?
I think I kind of see it as both. I see it as it has to be a good story that you could just read and not know anything about Pilgrim's Progress, or you could just read it and it would be about a man who goes on a walk because of a letter, and that would be enough and fulfilling. But also it is, I mean, the shoes, you know, people often say to me, why does he wear those yachting shoes? Why doesn't he buy more shoes? And then I get to the point where I have to say, well, they're a bit metaphorical, the shoes. And it's actually about when you think, you know, do you need all the stuff that you think that you need in order to do something you really know that you, you know, even if it's unconscious, something you need to do?
You know, you're fitting the allegory into a good, realistic story.
Yes, but I guess, you know, you can say that is what John Bunyan is doing.
Exactly, yes. And maybe that's the secret of why it was so successful, that although he has his, you know, as we'll see, there will be monsters, there will be demons that we meet along this journey. You know, it's a totally fantastical landscape he's passing through, and yet there is something realistic about the, as you say, the way he crawls up through, the way he feels scared by the things he's seeing. It's very believable.
It is, and he throws in detail all the time to kind of root us in things that we know. And I would say that, again, in storytelling, when I read somewhere, you can be as fanciful as you like, so long as you occasionally drop in details like Clark's shoes or whatever it is that people know, so then they can go, oh, I've got that little piece,
right,
and now my imagination can jump out?
Well, we're just coming into the town of Ampthill, which is named after a hill, rather a steep hill, which we're just about to head up now. And some people think that this is the model for the Hill of Difficulty in the Pilgrim's Progress.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
He lifted up his eyes, and behold, there was a very stately palace before him, the name whereof was Beautiful, and it stood just by the highway side.
When Christian gets to the top of the Hill of Difficulty, he comes to a place called the Palace Beautiful. But before he can get there, there's a very narrow passage, which was about a furlong off from the porter's lodge of this palace. And he sets off down this narrow passage, but then sees that halfway down, he espied two lions in the way. And I feel like we've walked into an equivalent of that narrow passage, haven't we? We've got to the top of the hill, and we're walking down a little avenue of trees.
Yeah.
And at the end, I can see it emerging through the trees, a rather spectacular structure. But maybe we're passing between the lions now. Initially, Christian is scared of them, but he calls out to the porter, and the porter says, if you look closely, you'll see they're chained to either wall, and if you walk down the very centre of the path, they won't be able to get to you.
But the lions are brilliantly placed, I think, because somebody before that has told us this,
right,
there are going to be lions.
Yes.
So John Bunyan is doing brilliant suspense building.
Yes, he meets someone fleeing down the hill.
He's setting up the lions for us, and then we see the lions, and then we find out that actually they're chained. But that if you're so fearful that you run away at this point, then you're not kind of worthy to be a pilgrim or to continue with the journey.
We're reaching the end of the avenue now, and we're looking at the shell of what was clearly once a really beautiful house. These are the remains of Houghton House, which was built in the early 17th century by the poet Mary Sidney, the sister of Sir Philip Sidney, also a poet. And she lived here. It was built in 1615. And John Bunyan may well have come here following his father's trade to fix household items which the house needed fixing. And wow, what an extraordinary prospect.
It's really imposing.
It almost looks more magnificent today in its ruined state. It's so dramatic.
Because you can see right through it, can't you, to the
sky. Yeah, it's like the skeleton or the shell of a building.
At the time it must have been amazing because there is nothing. I mean, there's blue sky and then there's this... Mm. I mean, the land just folds outwards, and then this huge red brick structure.
It's perched right on the edge of the hill, isn't it, looking out over Bedford Plain, and you can see for miles and miles around. Let's walk inside and see how it feels. When Christian arrives at the Palace Beautiful, which many people think Bunyan based on Houghton House, he's welcomed inside by piety, prudence and charity. And when Bunyan was alive, the house was owned by the Earl of Aylesbury, who had an amazing collection of objects. And it's interesting that piety, prudence and charity convinced Christian to stay here for several days and show him the sort of treasures of the house, these amazing sort of religious written works and jewels and so on. So now we're inside, you know, you can see the remains of fireplaces and interior walls. You can see where the upper floors would have met the walls from the change in the brickwork.
And the windows are vast,
they're big,
aren't they?
Yeah,
I mean, they're
they
very
are.
Kind of ambitious.
It must have been very light inside for a 17th century building.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the view through here. Look, I can see a train threading its way through the plain below us. That's a magnificent vista.
That really is something.
It's interesting to me that one of the characters that greets him here is Charity, one of the Christian graces. But charity is a theme that runs through your novel as well, isn't it, Rachel? That in some ways I feel like there's almost a sort of transformative moment for Harold Fry when he comes to a realization that he's been doing it wrong, and the way to do this pilgrimage is to rely on the charity of others.
Yeah.
And would you agree that's a moment where he sort of transitions from one state to another?
I think it is. I mean, I think it's similar to this moment where Christian arrives at the Palace Beautiful, in that they set him off with the armour that he needs.
Yes, they dress him in armour, yes.
For the rest of the journey, and they do show him the treasures. But similarly for Harold, he reaches a point where he realises that he has to be a guest, and that if you're a guest, it means you have to love and then you have to leave. And that you rely on the generosity, the charity of others, and that to do that is in itself an act of generosity when you allow somebody else to help you. You know, you come out of your own introverted place. Mm. But I do find it so fascinating being on this trail that we're going to all these places that Bunyan knew and loved and that he had a relationship with. And I think even though it's not specific to the writing, you know, that we know that it somehow permeates the writing, that kind of love of place, especially when we think about when he's writing in that jail or, you know, in the ice cream shop, as it now is. But, you know, just like you're in such an enclosed space.
Yeah.
And yet you're imagining, you're kind of filling your mind with these places that you know and you have a relationship with. I think you get it as you're reading, even if it's subliminal, you know it's there.
I think that's so true. And so fascinating to hear you as another writer recognising that in Bunyan's work. Well, as you say, these graces, they equip Christian with his armour, and he's, you know, in the illustrations to The Pilgrim's Progress, he suddenly is transformed into almost a kind of chivalric knight. He heads forth on his next phase of his journey.
Yes.
And
so
as
it's
we'll
a very important part, isn't it? It's almost like the end of Act One, you would say.
You
know,
yeah.
Like this is the kind of moment where he's equipped now to do the journey that he hasn't been equipped for before.
And as we'll discover, it's good timing that he's been given armour at this stage, because he's about to be sorely tested. So let's head back to the car and carry on following Christian's footsteps.
So he went on, and Apollyon met him. Now, the monster was hideous to behold. He was clothed with scales like a fish, and they are his pride. And he had wings like a dragon, feet like a bear, and out of his belly came fire and smoke, and his mouth was as the mouth of a lion.
So Christian sets off from the Palace Beautiful dressed in his armour, and he enters a couple of valleys which are terrifying in different ways. The first is the Valley of Humiliation, where he's attacked by this demon called Apollyon,
really terrifying, fire-breathing, scaly demon. And I think, you know, it's a biblical demon who appears in the book of Revelation. I think the name Apollyon means king of the locusts or something. And that's a dramatic fight, isn't it? It almost perishes, and he just manages to pull it back. And then he enters the Valley of the Shadow of Death. And this is just a really scary place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rachel, would you mind reading out, it's a horrible description of it in the book.
Yeah, it's as dark as pitch. We also saw here the hobgoblins, satyrs and dragons of the pit. We heard also in that valley a continual howling and yelling, as of a people under unutterable misery, who were sat down in affliction and irons. And over that valley hangs the discouraging clouds of confusion. Death also doth always spread his wings over it.
God. So, yeah, it's...
it's pretty bleak.
Bleak, this vision of a sort of personification of death spreading his wings and casting a shadow over this.
And hopelessness.
Yes. Well, luckily, Christian, you know, with his armour, he manages to get through these valleys. And it's been said, we're just passing now through the little village of Millbrook, and some people have said that Bunyan may have based the Valley of the Shadow of Death on Millbrook Gorge, which is one of the little valleys leading off this village. So maybe that's the case, who knows. But when he comes out of these two valleys, he meets another couple of pilgrims who join him, one called Faithful and one called Talkative. And Rachel, this reminds me of the moment in The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, when he's joined by other pilgrims. You know, the story of Harold walking up the length of the country starts to spread, and people start to join him, including a religious young man called Wilf and a rather talkative man called Rich Lion.
Yes.
And I wondered, you know, what is the difference between a solitary pilgrimage and a communal one?
Well, I think the communal one becomes, especially in Harold Fry, it becomes about the collective. It's no longer about the individual's journey. You know, whereas in the Bunyan, he's kind of forging a relationship with one fellow pilgrim who will you know, is a force for good and will continue with him. So is like-minded. I was thinking more about what happens when an idea gets taken over by social media and by people who are subverting it, who are no longer doing it for the good of the spirit or all the things that Harold is seeking to atone for or to understand, which is mainly this burden of guilt that he carries, similarly to Christian in the Pilgrim's Progress. And again, I always like it. I mean, people think I am losing the plot now, but I think that, like, I often think of Pinocchio in structure in terms of, I mean, it's got, I would say, you know, Disney, they knew what they were doing, but structurally, that kind of pleasure island, I think it's called, is very similar to Vanity Fair, you know, the place where you lose yourself. You just are so tempted by the outside world that actually you lose your purpose and you lose your journey, your sort of process of individuation, I guess I would call it. Mm-hmm. So it's the point where it is all threatened for Harold to be lost because he's so tempted by the sun, that, you know, the sort of sun figure, and also all these people that get in the way. And I'd say Talkative is the same temptation. You know,
yes.
He could subvert it.
Well, talking of Vanity Fair, that is, of course, one of the most famous locations in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Perhaps most famous because, of course, William Thackeray used the title Vanity Fair for his great 19th century novel set during the Napoleonic Wars. But Vanity Fair it's a town that Christian and Faithful arrive in, and there's this huge, raucous, materialist fair going on where you can buy anything, right?
Yeah.
And Bunyan may have based this on fairs that he would have come across, like Stourbridge Fair near Cambridge, but also there was a fair at Bedford, and there was a fair at Ampthill, the town of Ampthill, which we're just approaching the outskirts of now. And what do you think is the significance of Vanity Fair, Rachel? Because sort of everything's available to buy there, but Christian says we're here to buy the truth.
Yes. I mean, I find this bit of Pilgrim's Progress really shocking when I read it, because it's so... well, it's so severe. I mean, it's brutal. It's death.
Yeah.
So in standing up for their own truth, one of them is killed.
Yeah.
It's a kind of
strange moment, isn't it?
Just, it is.
It's almost because they're different to everyone else at the fair, but the whole town turns on them.
It turns on them because they refuse to be the same as everybody else. And so it's, you know, that moment where you refuse to endorse what you disagree with. You know, and throughout history, people have suffered for standing up for what they believe. But it is a very shocking part of, because I think as well it's so vividly written.
Yes.
The
Faithful
trial.
There's a trial, and then Faithful is literally burnt at the stake.
Yeah, I mean, it's a brutal death.
Yeah.
And he describes it very vividly.
We're just entering Ampt Hill now, so perhaps we could imagine these streets lined with booths and stalls and crowded with people, and this could be our stand-in for Vanity Fair today.
It's rather beautiful, though, that's the problem.
Yeah,
I think
yes,
I might be seduced.
Enticing, yes.
They presently saw a town before them, and the name of that town is Vanity. And at the town there is a fair kept called Vanity Fair. It is kept all the year long. At this fair are all such merchandise sold as houses, lands, trades, places, honours, preferments, titles, countries, kingdoms, lusts, pleasures, and delights of all sorts, as whores, bawds, wives, husbands, children, masters, servants, lives, blood, bodies, souls, silver, gold, pearls, precious stones, and what not.
We're just outside Ampt Hill now, in Ampt Hill Great Park, which is a big expanse of rolling grassy parkland with clumps of trees and wooded areas. And we've come up onto one of the heights, and we're standing in the spot that used to be Ampt Hill Castle. A huge castle used to stand here, and the sort of historical significance of Ampt Hill Castle is that this is where Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife, lived after he had divorced her, and she lived here till the end of her days. And we're standing next to a pillar with a cross on the top of it, known as Catherine's Cross, which marks that spot. But Rachel, I thought this could be a good place to stand in for the next location that Christian meets on his pilgrimage, because after Vanity Fair, when Faithful is burned at the stake, he's joined by another pilgrim called Hopeful.
Yeah.
And they're walking along and following the narrow path, and then they see a little stile off to the left and a lovely meadow running parallel with the path, and they think, oh, maybe it would be no problem just to hop over this stile and walk in this lovely countryside. But of course, this is a diversion from the path they should be following. And when they sleep in this meadow, they're discovered by the owner of the land, this giant called Despair, who brings them back to Doubting Castle and locks them in the prison there. This is one of the most dramatic moments in the book, right?
It is. It's sort of like, you know, Grimm's fairy tales.
Yeah.
It's visceral. It's nasty. I mean, I'm gripped by it though as I'm reading it, as to how are they going to get away from this? Because you do throughout, you think, oh, how is he going to avoid this? How is he going to avoid this? But a lot of it is about conversation. But this, they're actually locked away, and they're being punished every night by him, and his wife keeps sending him back down the giant.
And they keep expecting to be eaten by him at any moment.
Yes, or torn limb from limb.
Right.
I think that's the other option.
Right. Yeah, he describes, you know, considering Bunyan had spent so much time in prison himself, he describes the castle as a very dark dungeon, nasty and stinking to the spirit. And they're not given food, they're not given water or light. And actually, in fact, in the second part, when Christiana comes past Doubting Castle, she recruits the help of fellow pilgrims, and they end up destroying Doubting Castle. It's razed to the ground, so it's appropriate that we're standing on the former site of a castle. But doubt, you know, this is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that Christian the Pilgrim comes across, and doubt must surely be the sort of the thing that must be hardest for pilgrims to deal with. And certainly Harold Fry meets with doubt, right? There's a moment where, you know, the reason he's going on this pilgrimage is that this old friend has written a letter saying that she's dying from cancer, and he's decided to walk to her.
Yeah.
And at one point he meets an oncologist.
Yes.
Who just very rationally says, you know, I'd never tell a patient there was nothing to be done unless I was absolutely certain. Harold, you have a wife and son. If I may say so, you look tired. Yeah. Is it really necessary to walk?
Yeah.
And he has this crisis, doesn't
he? It is a crisis. I think it is his... along the way, he has about three crises. There's a physical crisis, just like Christian our pilgrim. But this one is about a crisis of doubt, uh-huh. of faith. And that's... I think it's where you meet the rational world. And how do you answer that? Mm. There is... Mm. So he is kind of incapacitated by doubt. But it was also very much when I was writing, I was thinking, you know, doubt is the thing that is inside us, isn't it, that we have to deal with. And as a writer, I was very much dealing with my own doubt. So it was very useful to feed it in, you know, because part of the creative process, I think, as faith, must be doubt.
I completely see that, and it works so well in the narrative because as readers, we've been so swept along with his confidence and his optimism.
Yeah.
And then when this oncologist, you know, lays out the facts, as a reader you think, of course, yes, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, we don't want to spoil the book for readers who haven't read it yet, but in Pilgrim's Progress, the way they get out of this dungeon is Christian says, I have a key in my bosom called Promise that will, I am persuaded, open any lock in Doubting Castle. And having discovered that key, suddenly all the doors open to them and Hopeful and Christian escape. And there's a phone call in Harold Fry, right, that it's a similar moment, but unlocks the pilgrimage again.
And completely similar, yes. I mean, it's the moment in, you know, if you were filming Pilgrim's Progress, the big music would come, isn't it? The swishy swirly, yes, we're off, everything is good again, we're back on track.
Well, Christian and Hopeful escape from Doubting Castle, and rather appropriately, they get back to the stile and they decide to erect a pillar there to point out to people not to make the mistake they have. And so how appropriate that we're standing on the ruins of a former castle next to a commemorative pillar. On which note, let's continue. Let's head on to our final stop for today's pilgrimage, the Celestial City. Rachel, we're just approaching the outskirts of London now, coming down the M1. And like Christian, we're nearing the end of our pilgrimage. After the Delectable Mountains, he passes through the Enchanted Ground, which is a bit like with the Wizard of Oz. It seems to be this ground where it's very easy to fall asleep and they need to keep talking to get through it. And then he arrives in Beulah, this very bucolic, beautiful land, just on the very verge of the destination, with lovely meadows and streams and so on. But then they come to the final hurdle, right? This deep river that has no bridge, and they need to ford across it. And you realise that this, in the allegory, this is the river of death, that this is the final hurdle that Christians need to step over before they reach heaven. And Christian and Hopeful start crossing this river, and Christian loses his footing and thinks he's going to drown. And in that moment, he kind of gives up. Sort of almost allows himself to be sucked below the waves. And this is very similar, I think, to the section towards the end of Harold Fry, when he's almost at the end of his pilgrimage.
Yeah.
In fact, he really has reached the end of his pilgrimage, and then he gets very confused. He kind of he ends up taking detours he doesn't mean to. He's not quite sure where he is or what he's doing. And why did that feel like an important element of his journey?
It feels important for lots of reasons, but one is that I think as you get nearer to the place that you're going, instead of feeling kind of sharp and knowing where you're heading, you're suddenly about to arrive, and I think there's a point of crisis where you suddenly doubt whether or not you're worthy to be there and whether you can actually see it through and whether you're able to kind of go, you know, what will happen when you get there? What's the next point? And I think with Christian in the river, doesn't he feel that he can't see Christ anymore? It's a sort of moment where
he's lost sight
of the end. And similarly for me, when writing Harold Fry, it felt that just as he's getting close to getting there, there's one last thing he hasn't really dealt with. And so for me, instead of being able just to walk straight to the hospice and go in, he walks to the hospice and then presses the doorbell and then walks away again because he's not ready.
It's hopeful. It's the character of hope,
yes,
in Pilgrim's Progress who reaches out to Christian and gives him his hand and yes, pulls him through to the other side of this river.
Yes. Well, similarly for Harold, there is Maureen, who's been so, yes, against the walk for the whole journey, practically. And the moment that he says to her, "You're right, I want to come home," she realises that if he doesn't finish it, he will never forgive himself. And so what she does is, I think, the kind of supreme act of courage and love, in that she says, "No, you have to keep going." So for both of them, it's a big turning point and it's a big test.
Well, we can imagine, as we sort of, we're about to cross the North Circular Road, the ring road around London, so we can imagine that's the river of death that we're, yes, going to cross, hopefully successfully,
yes,
and head on into to our final stop.
The city stood upon a mighty hill, but the pilgrims went up that hill with ease because they had these two men to lead them up by the arms, and also they had left their mortal garments behind them in the river, for though they went in with them, they came out without them. They therefore went up here with much agility and speed, though the foundation upon which the city was framed was higher than the clouds.
Well, like Christian, we're just approaching the very end of our pilgrimage today. We're walking into the extraordinary burial ground of Bunhill Fields in the City of London, an old plague pit and which became the dissenters' graveyard. And really on either side, Rachel, there are just higgledy-piggledy gravestones, tombs, mausoleums. It's a really spectacular place. And in the sort of central clearing which we're coming into now, I can see a big obelisk to Daniel Defoe. To the right of that is a gravestone to William Blake. But if we turn in this direction, we come to the resting place of John Bunyan, one of the most impressive tombs here, with the figure of Bunyan lying on his back, on top of the casket, and then a relief sculpture of Christian the Pilgrim with his burden on his back.
That's very moving to see that.
It is, especially having started with very active preaching,
yes,
statue this morning.
Yes.
Well, in The Pilgrim's Progress, when Christian finally arrives at the Celestial City, which in some ways he seems to have mapped onto London, he says that when Christian and Hopeful went in at the gate, lo, as they entered, they were transfigured, and they had raiment put on that shone like gold. And then I heard in my dream that all the bells in the city rang again for joy. And Rachel, here at the end of our journey, having retraced the steps of The Pilgrim's Progress today, has that changed the way you see that book at all, the way our experience today?
Well, it's an amazing thing when you actually follow the trail of a book, you know, when you bring the book to life for yourself, because you engage with it in a different way. I mean, I think you partly engage with it in more of a kind of writer, you know, writer's way. You try to think more about what was going on for him, which is really interesting for us. But you do just get the scale of it,
yes,
as well. And also you really, I think what I've really got today is the beauty of it.
Yes. Yes,
and
the
that kind of sense,
the...
you know, even now, you know, we're seeing that little house where he lived in Bedford, and there are wheelie bins outside, and it feels so kind of such a kind of conflict between the old and the new. And then you step out, and you sort of feel you're in a timeless landscape again. You know,
completely.
It's interesting how close it actually is.
Well, what a great way to finish our conversation and our pilgrimage today. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. It's been
a real
pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been great.
Many thanks to Rachel Joyce, to John Pestel and the John Bunyan Museum, to Naxos Audiobooks for the clips of David Shaw Parker reading from The Pilgrim's Progress, and to our kind partners, Penguin Classics.
I'm Henry Elliott. The producer is Andrea Rangecroft, and the music is by Don Gould. If you enjoyed this episode of On the Road with Penguin Classics, please spread the word and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And I'll leave you with this, an extract from Vera Brittain's biography, In the Steps of John Bunyan. She summarises the achievement of the Pilgrim's Progress. Bunyan made Bedfordshire's homely villages and peaceful streams shine with the light of heaven itself, and turned the life of an ordinary man struggling to overcome his daily temptations into a journey as heroic as Jason's quest for the Golden Fleece. He neither knew nor cared that at a single step he had created the English novel, with its long history and infinite variety.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.